you for your testimony today.
Okay, just one brief question. You've been around government a long time and a number of administrations.
Once again, the chairman, Tom Kaine.
Based on that experience, period from March to August 2001, was that an exceptionally long time to develop a new policy of the kind of complexity of the president's policy in Al-Qaeda?
Not really. It was a complex issue, and it's not as if we were not doing anything but sitting around working on NSPD. We were reaching out to Uzbekistan. We were continuing to work with Pakistan. We were engaged diplomatically. We were following up on various UN actions that had been taken. And so there was work going on. Ms. Gerlach made reference to visas. We were in the process of reviewing our visa policy. We had the tip-off system, but it was not really serving the full intended purpose. It was going to be the basis of the Terrorist Threat Information Center that came later. And so there were many things that were going on, and not just everybody standing still waiting for NSPD to be finished. Keep in mind that we dealt with the issue of what's the status of the Predator. What's the status of the Northern Alliance? And you may want to add a word to that, Rich.
Thank you. The development of this, what we consider to be a comprehensive policy, was
Deputy
one that
Secretary
the members who are sitting on the commission who served on Capitol Hill will recognize the complexities of. Some of the things we had to do in order to move forward with Pakistan involved removing an unbelievable number of sanctions, which were put on people with very strong views on Capitol Hill. We were already in the process of working that out. That does not happen in a week. The same is true of India, who are under sanctions. So, as the Secretary said, we weren't just sitting around. Now, the question of the Northern Alliance has come up several times, and people wonder why it was so hard to come to a decision. Well, beyond the drug dealing that they did, well, that caused us some trouble. Behind the human rights tragedy that they inflicted in the 1996 time period, that took us a little time to get over. It's not sufficient to be the enemy of our enemy, to be our friend. To be our friend, you have to share or be willing to at least embrace to some extent our values. And that's why the question of the Northern Alliance wasn't an easy one. It was a tough one.
Commissioner Benveniste.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Richard Benveniste, he is a Washington lawyer who has served on
a
variety of investigations
and
committees, including the Watergate Committee.
Dedicated service to our country. As you know, I have long been a personal admirer of yours, and thank you again for your commitment and service. Secretary Armitage, the administration has asked that you be allowed to testify tomorrow in place of Condoleezza Rice. No one could suggest that her role is not central to our inquiry and that her knowledge is different from yours, as she was a direct liaison between the President and the CIA and the FBI on issues directly relevant to our inquiry. That is why the Commission unanimously requested that Dr. Rice appear. The only reason the administration has advanced for refusing to make Dr. Rice available is a separation of powers argument that presidential advisors ought not have to appear before the Congress. I would call to your attention a report by the Congressional Research Service dated April 5, 2002, well before the controversy arose about Dr. Rice's appearance. In that report, there are many precedents involving presidential advisors. Lloyd Cutler, counsel to President Carter, testified, came up to Congress to answer questions. Zbigniew Brzezinski, assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, appeared in 1980. Samuel Berger appeared as a deputy assistant to the President for National Security in May of 1994. He reappeared as in his function as National Security Advisor in September of 1997. John Podesta, chief of staff to President Clinton, and several others in the Clinton administration have appeared before congressional committees. And I may add that after this report was prepared, Governor Ridge appeared before two committees of the Congress. So I would ask Mr. Armitage, without any disparagement of your service or of your knowledge, that when you leave here today, you advise the administration of this report. I've got an extra copy for you to take with you. And we ask again, in all seriousness, that Dr. Rice appear. Secretary Powell, let me ask you this. I'd like to turn your attention to the immediate events after 9/11. You were in Peru on that day. You flew back. It must have been a dreadfully painful experience on several levels, not the least of which was your inability to communicate during that long trip back. Thereafter, you met with members of the cabinet and the president at Camp David. And my friend Secretary Lehman has brought up the subject of Iraq with Secretary Albright. You and I met with other members of the commission on the 21st of January of this year. On that occasion, you advised us of a full-day meeting on Saturday, September 15th, in which the question of striking Iraq was discussed. You advised us that the Deputy Secretary of Defense advanced the argument that Iraq was the source of the problem and that the United States should launch an attack on Iraq forthwith. You advised us that Secretary Wolfowitz was unable to justify that position. Have I accurately described your recollection of what occurred?
There was a meeting of the National Security Council that Mr. Wolfowitz also attended on that day at Camp David, as you described. There was a full day of discussions on the situation that we found ourselves in, who was responsible for it. And as part of that full day of discussion, Iraq was discussed. And Secretary Wolfowitz raised the issue of whether or not Iraq should be considered for action during this time. And after fully discussing all sides of the issue, as I think it is appropriate for such a group to do, the President made a tentative decision that afternoon. I would call it a tentative decision that we ought to focus on Afghanistan because it was clear to us at that point that al-Qaeda was responsible, the Taliban was harboring al-Qaeda, and that that should be the objective of any action we were to take. He did not dismiss Iraq as a problem, but he said, first things first, we will examine all of the sources of terrorism directed against the United States and the civilized world, but we'll start with Afghanistan. Now, he confirmed that over the next couple of days in meetings we had with him. And when he came back down from Camp David and we met on Monday, he made it a firm decision and gave us all instructions as to how to proceed. And then he announced that to the nation later in the week. And so he heard arguments, as he should, from all members of his administration on the different alternatives. I think this is what the President would expect us to do.
You have
decided on Afghanistan.
Excuse me. You have characterized Secretary Wolfowitz.
This last question. Mm-hmm. Just time.
Secretary Wolfowitz's position as whether or not we ought to attack Iraq. Is it not the case that he advocated for an attack on Iraq?
He presented the case for Iraq and whether or not it should be considered along with Afghanistan at this time. I can't recall whether he said instead of Afghanistan. We all knew that Afghanistan was where al-Qaeda was.
Was there any concrete basis upon which that recommendation was founded, in your view? Back Iraq before 9/11.
Secretary Wolfowitz was deeply concerned about Iraq being a source of terrorist activity. You will have a chance to talk to him directly about
it. I've asked for your view with all due respect, Secretary Powell.
With all due respect, I don't think I should characterize what Mr. Wolfowitz's views were.
No, I asked for your view, and your view was there a basis.
My view was that we listened to all the arguments at Camp David that day, and Mr. Wolfowitz felt that Iraq should be considered as part of this problem having to do with terrorism, and he wanted us to consider whether or not it should be part of any military action that we were getting ready to take. We all heard the argument fully. We asked questions back and forth. And where the president came down was that Afghanistan was the place that we had to attack because the world, the American people, would not understand if we didn't go after the source of the 9/11 terrorists.
I'm out of time, and I'm going to listen to my chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Well, Mr. Secretary, to both you and Secretary Armitage, I mean, I would prefer
Senator Bob Kerry,
Dr. Rice here
of Nebraska,
would be here tomorrow,
former
but
Senator.
Dick, you would be a fabulous national security advisor. you would be a dynamite one. So, that said, let me say that with great respect, I'm having difficulty with we spent 8 months developing a plan because I don't think that's the central problem here. And my recollection of the presidential campaign, and by the way, my actions in presidential campaigns were kept intact in 2000. I supported the loser in the primary, so my memory may not be very good, but I don't recall terrorism being much, if even an issue at all, in the 2000 campaign, and in part because it really, even though it was on the policymakers' minds, they were aware of the threat and they're aware of what's going on, but I just don't recall it being a driving force in either one of the campaigns. Now, maybe I've got that wrong, but I don't think so. And I think the central problem, Mr. Secretary, is something that all three of us have dealt with from time to time, and that was the use of military force in dealing with al-Qaeda. I said earlier to Secretary Albright, I think it was one of the big mistakes of the Clinton administration, and frankly, I think it was also a fault of the Bush administration, although I'm sympathetic that the Secretary of Defense was not a primary actor in the war on terrorism. Indeed, striking, his recollection of the briefings on al-Qaeda were considerably different than yours. Now, his recollection may be different when he's testifying, but he just didn't. It wasn't as clear, and it shouldn't be, because under Presidential Directive 62, which was signed by President Clinton in 98, that presidential directive didn't give the Department of Defense a primary role in the war on terrorism. It just didn't in counterterrorism activity. So, I've read the cautionary concern that General Zinni had, who was sink of CENTCOM at the time, and other military leaders. I've had in 12 years' experience in the United States Senate many times to walk out wondering if I voted the right way. And among those moments was Desert Storm 1, where I'm relatively certain today that I did vote the wrong way. But it came from a concern for body bags coming home and would we be able to sustain the effort, the political effort. And I was likewise concerned about Bosnia. I ended up supporting the effort in Bosnia and Kosovo. But those who say we shouldn't be skeptical or concerned about use of military force, I think, have got it wrong. We should be. And we should, it seems to me, always wonder. But I wonder if you see it that way. I mean, I wonder if you see that if you look at from 93, when World Trade Center 1 was hit the first time, and through September of 2001, Al-Qaeda never suffered a military response from us, never, other than on August 20th, which was a relatively small military attack, a very limited military attack with absolutely no anticipation of boots on the ground being involved. And I'm just wondering, I appreciate that I'm asking a question as if you were Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, and perhaps even President, not just Secretary of State. But I wonder if you see it that way as well, that our reluctance to give the Secretary of Defense and the military a more prominent role in counterterrorism efforts contributed to our lack of preparation. Because the bottom line for me is, it pains me to have to say that on the 11th September, that 19 men with less than $500,000 defeated every single defensive mechanism we had in place. Utterly. It wasn't even a close call. They defeated everything we had in place on the 11th of September with hardly, it seems to me, any doubt about their chance of success. And I just stop there and give you a chance to tell me what you think went wrong.
Let me speak to our administration, and I'll speak more generally to get to the heart of your question. I think in our deliberations and our meetings, and Mr. Armitage may wish to speak to this, the Pentagon was starting to develop plans. It was looking at contingencies that it might have to deal with. And you can pursue this with Secretary Rumsfeld this afternoon. But in this whole period, to say that use military force to get al-Qaeda when it wasn't going to be a surgical strike. Anybody who thinks that, you know, Osama bin Laden might just be laying around somewhere and you can go pick him up, well, maybe. Good luck. But that's a wish, not a strategy or not a military action. So you would have had really to go after al-Qaeda by going after the Taliban, and that meant invading another country. And it meant invading another country without the support of any of the surrounding countries where you would need some access to get there. And so I don't know that in this period from 93 through the summer of 2001, you had a sufficient political base and sufficient political understanding both here and in the international community that would have given you a basis for saying that we know enough about al-Qaeda, we know enough about the Taliban, that we are going in to invade this country and remove this threat.
Could I respond to that? Because
just a minute response.
Response. Because Secretary Albright said the same thing, and I was there in 91 when you and former President Bush and Secretary Cheney went to the world and persuaded the world that we needed to drive Iraq out of Kuwait. Public opinion wasn't on your side either when you began. Public opinion wasn't on the side of President Clinton when he suggested that we needed to intervene in Bosnia. It wasn't on the side of the administration when they decided to intervene in Kosovo. It's rare that public opinion is on the side of a president or a political leader when it comes to using military force, except after the fact. So it does seem to me to be, in many ways, sort of a straw man position to say, gee, it would have been exceptionally difficult. Yes, it would have been exceptionally difficult, but history is replete of examples where political leaders made a decision in spite of public opinion being on the other side and saying, I've got to persuade people because I see it being an urgent necessity.
I don't think that in the case of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan during this period, it rose to that level of urgent necessity that people thought, you know, we've got to go do this now, even if it includes major invasion of a country without the support of any of the surrounding countries. Do we have a sufficient cause and justification to undertake such action? And previous administration can speak for itself, but they spoke for themselves. They said they didn't see it. And frankly, in our first 7 months in office, as we looked at this, we realized that it might come to that. That's the realization we come to. And you come to these kinds of realizations after a great deal of study and debate. You don't walk in on the first day and we have decided this is what has to be done. So we discussed it with all of the experts who were in the previous administration and stayed over. We then brought in our new people. Mr. Armitage came in after 2 months. General Taylor came over after a while. A lot of new people came in. And we put together a more comprehensive policy. And we reached the conclusion in early September that it might come to that. And we have to understand that we might have to go in and take this kind of large-scale military action if that was the only way to eliminate this threat.
Congressman Roma.
Record that I have of our discussions and the deputies in the July timeframe where we began to discuss actually using military measures. If all the rest was not successful, that's a long ways from having a plan and a military plan. But these were things that, as the Secretary has indicated, we talked about, we debated, and we realized eventually we were going to have in our quiver.
Congressman Roma.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome to both of you, Secretary Powell and Secretary Armitage, thank
this
you again
This is Congressman
for your service
Tim Romer,
time.
Former Congressman Tim Romer of Indiana.
Wide chorus of praise for you, Mr. Secretary, in your career, both in public service, but also in the private sector when you were trying to get the American people more engaged in volunteer service. Let me pick somebody else who joins in that praise of you that is widely condemning almost everybody else in the Bush administration for not acting quickly enough on terrorism. Richard Clark, in his new book on page 228, says, Colin Powell took the unusual steps during the transition of asking to meet with the CSG, the Counterterrorism Security Group, took notes, and was surprised at the unanimity of the recommendations and the threat of al-Qaeda. He paid careful attention and asked Mr. Armitage to follow up on it. Very blunt, very praiseworthy, very complimentary of your understanding the problem. In that PowerPoint presentation that he made to you, he in fact said, they're here. One of the slides said that al-Qaeda was in the United States. Doesn't that in fact say two things? One, that 9 months is too long to act. That you have to do some intermediary thing. You have to take some immediate steps. And two, if you're going to go from a rollback strategy to an elimination strategy, if you're going to go from swatting flies to exterminating the flies, you've got to have something to exterminate them with, whether it's Predator, Northern Alliance, aid to Uzbekistan, covert operation. You have to be taking some of these actions. The USS Cole, why didn't we take at least some of those actions in the meantime as this nine-month bottom-up review took place?
I don't remember the specific PowerPoint slide, and I didn't turn to Mr. Armitage because he wasn't there yet. He didn't show up for another 2 months. And if Mr. Clark was aware...
Well, just to clear the record, he later asked Armitage to get involved.
But there were others working for me at the time that I asked. And the time that he gave me the briefing, I was not the Secretary of State. This administration was not in office. And if, according to this slide, Mr. Clark and the members of the previous administration who were briefing me that day, this was the 20th of December, a month before inauguration, if they were aware that al-Qaeda representatives were already in the country running around and knew that these 19, if that's the reference in that passage, they were running around inside the country, the obligation, frankly, is on them, not why didn't we do something beginning a month later? Why hadn't they done something while they were preparing the PowerPoint presentation? And so I haven't read that section of the book.
That's certainly in our questions to Mr. Clark tomorrow, as he's a sworn participant tomorrow for over 2 hours. We intend to ask him many of those questions.
Yeah. But
today, as the Bush administration moved forward from January on, why not you exercise some of these options?
The options were not options. There was no option for an armed predator. The armed predator did not exist.
Recon predator.
The recon predator, it was analyzed very carefully, and I think Director Tenet will be speaking about this, that it was a waste of the asset at that point to have it fly around and become identified and its pattern of operation, method of operation, become known to those on the ground who it was looking for, and the Taliban did have some aircraft that might have been capable of going up and taking the predator down. A judgment was made that since we couldn't use the reconnaissance information from the Predator to immediately target that which the Predator found, let's not give away its signature and other aspects of its operational capability until we could do that. And it was a crash effort all during 2001, in the first 7 months of this administration, to get it armed. And it was armed in September, and as soon as it was armed, as soon as it was tested, we knew what it could do, it was used. And it was used effectively, and it was used repeatedly. The Northern Alliance question, we've answered. This was not a force that had the capability to take down the Taliban or to remove al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan. And as Secretary Armitage just described, we had significant issues that we had to work our way through. And it took time to work our way through these issues and to do it in a way that did not offend other tribes or other groups within Afghanistan that might have taken a dim view of what we were doing with the Northern Alliance.
But, Mr. Secretary, then this elimination of al-Qaeda was a 3 or 5 year process. It was not anything that was going to take place anytime soon.
I think Mr. Clark says that he saw it as a 3 to 5 year process. It is not a matter of, okay, fine, I want to eliminate al-Qaeda, so tomorrow morning I'm going to go do it.
That was the last one.
Al-Qaeda does not quite present that kind of a target to you. You have to work diplomatically, politically, law enforcement, get inside the financing of al-Qaeda and similar organizations, ultimately to bring them down and put them and to put them on the run.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Congressman. Senator Gorton.
Senator Slade Gorton, a former Republican member of the Senate from Washington.
Mr. Secretary, you weren't able to read your entire statement, but I think your conclusion, which is both thoughtful and frightening, deserves to be on the oral record as well as in the written record, and it does lead to my one question. You say that fundamental is this: sometimes you can do almost everything right and still suffer grievous losses from terrorist attacks. The recent train bombings in Spain demonstrate this tragic but inescapable fact. Spanish authorities were well prepared. Spain's highly capable security forces were on high alert, and security had been increased across the country. In fact, several weeks earlier, they had apprehended terrorists with a truckload of explosives. Nonetheless, and despite all their best efforts and all their precautions, Spain still suffered these horrific attacks that produced such terrible casualties. Before this war is won, there will be more such attacks. Now, the fact that we don't like to talk about in public for fear of what consequences it might have is the fact that we have now gone 2.5 years in the United States without an Islamic extremist successful terrorist attack here. We may have prevented some, but in a sense, nothing has happened. I'd like you to give me your opinion, to the extent that you feel able to do so, of the reasons for that. How much of it is blind luck? How much of it is the fact that we've hardened targets? How much of it is the fact or the proposition that we have more effective intelligence and prevention than we did before 9/11? How much of it is due to the fact that we have attacked the sources, the physical sources of it? And how much of it is due to the fact that all of these things together may simply not have ended terrorism? Obviously, it did not, but simply displaced it to Indonesia, to Morocco, to Turkey, to Saudi Arabia, to Spain, to places in which the targets are easier and softer.
Sir, we are still vulnerable, and you should accept that, and we'll always be vulnerable as long as we are a free and open society. But we have done a number of things that I hope have deterred attacks, made it harder for people to plot against the United States, and have perhaps scared them into thinking, well, we wouldn't be as successful as we might have been a couple of years ago. Creation of the Department of Homeland Security. The manner in which we took the tip-off database that Ms. Gorelick spoke about and have now used it to create a much larger database, and we're pulling all the FBI, CIA, State Department databases into one system. The fact that we have changed our visa policy significantly, we're now starting to fingerprint people coming into the country and getting a better ID on them. The fact that we have done a lot of work on our borders. The fact that we have the Transportation Security Administration that does a better job of looking at who's coming into the country at our airports and other places of entry and points of entry. So I hope that these defensive measures we have taken are deterring attacks and are giving people who might come after us pause. Is there not a better place that we can go and conduct one of these terrible attacks and make the same point to the world about our philosophy and our evil intent, and maybe that's why they have gone elsewhere. I think it also illustrates why nobody is immune and we all have to work together. And so I hope that as a result of the attack in Spain, the attack in Bali, the attack in Riyadh, the attack in so many other places in the world, we'll pull the civilized world together and do cause us to do a better job of sharing intelligence information, law enforcement information, financial cooperation, and direct action against terrorist organizations. But I can't give you a measure for each one of these steps, Mr. Gordon. It's just not possible, and we're still vulnerable. A nation as large as ours, fairly open, and we can't shut down our openness. We cannot be so afraid that we don't let anybody into our country. It's costing us now. We don't let students come to our universities because we're concerned, or they don't want to come to our universities because they are afraid of the difficulty of getting a visa, even if they're fully qualified for visa, or the harassment they sometimes feel at our airports. So we have to secure the homeland, but we also have to remain an open nation, or the terrorists win. But I hope that all of the efforts the President has taken over the last couple of years have contributed to our deterrent effect against terrorist activity.
So you feel that to a certain extent there has been genuine deterrence, a reduction in it, but also a significant degree of displacement.
Yeah, well, deterrence for sure. We have made it a lot harder for people to come and move freely about our country, and they know we're looking for them. And we know that the policies the President has put in place for the purpose of finding these folks before they get us. With respect to displacement, we know we have pretty much crippled their ability to work in Afghanistan. I can't say that we've gotten them all. There may be some remnants left. But we also know they're trying to recreate themselves elsewhere. That's why what Secretary Rumsfeld's doing with his footprint of our military forces and what Director Tenet is doing and will speak to you about are so important. We've got to chase them and find them wherever they surface in these other places in the world. Rich?
Probably the best deterrent, Senator, in addition to those the Secretary has mentioned, is about
Deputy
the 500
Secretary
Al-Qaeda
Armitage.
That have been wrapped up by Pakistan, and the dozens who have been killed and arrested by the Saudis, particularly after their May 12th bombings. That's part of deterrence, too. You've got to have the sharp edge of the pointy edge of the spear.
Just to put a P.S. on that, I mean, some of these organizations, particularly Al-Qaeda, thought they were getting a free ride in certain places. They've now discovered there's no free ride in Saudi Arabia, and you see what President Musharraf's been doing in recent days in that battle that's taking place up in the tribal areas. And they know they're going to be engaged, and you can be sure they're going to be engaged by Spanish authorities. And so they know there's no longer any impunity associated with their actions, and the world hopefully is coming together. We must not let the success of some of these actions, such as the Spanish disaster, cause us to back away from the campaign against terrorism. It's cause us to redouble our efforts.
Thank you very much, Secretary Powell, Deputy Secretary Armitage. Thank you for being with us. We would like to submit you a few more questions for the record, and we look forward to your reply on those. We're now going to adjourn till 1:30. I would ask the audience, by the way, before you leave, the Capitol Police have asked us to announce that as people leave the room for lunch, please do not leave bags, packages, unattached things in the room, because the Capitol Police may take them away, and they won't be here when you get back. So thank you all very much. We'll reconvene promptly at 1:30, audience, and please the commissioners be here at that time.
That is the chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Thomas Kane. He's the former governor of New Jersey. He's a university president now, president of Drew University. Mary Louise Kelly is here with me in a sort of a skybox arrangement overlooking the Intelligence Committee hearing room. This is a special, secure hearing room which the commission has borrowed for purposes of these hearings. Mary Louise, we heard the same kind of thread continuing in the questioning of Colin Powell that we heard with Madeleine Albright. Did the Bush administration know enough and do enough, essentially, to prevent, I guess, 9/11?
That's right. We heard this morning several of almost the exact same questions being directed at the current Secretary of State, Colin Powell, and Madeleine Albright, the previous Secretary of State from the Clinton administration. And to a certain degree, you know, certain threads of continuity in the answers, both saying we did as much as we could based on what we knew. I mean, you know, we heard both Madeleine Albright and Colin Powell stressing, look, if it were as easy as just going and bombing the heck out of Afghanistan when we knew Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were there, that would have been great, but it wasn't that easy. I mean, for starters, we didn't before 9/11 have public opinion on our side to do that. Congress wouldn't have backed it. International allies that have been key, such as Pakistan, probably wouldn't have backed it before September 11th. Both of them really stressing how very different the world looks now as opposed to the early months of the Bush administration and, of course, the Clinton administration.
Now, another pre-9/11 reality was that the United States and in its activities was governed by different strictures, different laws, different policies. The concept of simply going after a group which had not necessarily been proven to be a participant in something that harmed the United States was considerably less possible.
That's right.
Colin Powell emphasized, well, and I guess basically what they both said was that they did a great deal. And, of course, hanging over the whole thing is that whatever they did, it wasn't enough.
That's right. I mean, Madeleine Albright herself made the point that that after September 11th, when the U.S. did go in and bomb Afghanistan, it still didn't lead to the capture of Osama bin Laden and other senior al-Qaeda leaders who, to our knowledge, are still roaming free somewhere in Afghanistan or Pakistan.
Colin Powell, in his testimony, emphasized to a much greater extent than other members of the Bush administration, at least in recent days, have been doing, he emphasized continuity. Talking about how he was briefed, he had all kinds of information, he kept all kinds of people on at the State Department who were part of the previous administration, and that he had he wouldn't quite buy into the notion that one of the commissioners proposed that the Bush administration's final policies on counterterrorism were sort of on a trajectory from the Clinton administration. He wasn't quite prepared to go that far.
True, although, Linda, he did stress that the Bush administration was not handed a counterterrorism action plan from the Clinton administration, that they tried to keep on a lot of the expertise, they tried to listen, and he said we were very well briefed by the outgoing administration, but they didn't hand us a plan. It's not like they gave us a plan and we failed to act on it.
So there's a certain amount watching your back, taking care of not excuses perhaps, but trying to emphasize that a great deal was done on both sides. I must say that I thought that Madeleine Albright's statement was much more sort of pointed than Colin Powell's. But then, of course, he is the Secretary of State, and she was the Secretary of State.
I think that's right. He's in power right now and perhaps can't be quite as candid about what he knew and when he knew it and what warnings may or may not have been heeded. We should point out here that the sort of absent voice, which has already been noted in these hearings, is that of Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor. She is the only member of the Bush administration not here in the sense that the Clinton counterparts are all here. We have Sandy Berger, National Security Advisor from that administration. Condoleezza Rice, his current counterpart, not here. And we heard a plea from one of the commissioners today saying we would love to have her testify. So far, the White House has declined to allow her to.
But the reason they give is that this is a separation of powers issue, that for her to come and testify would in some way injure the separation of powers between what? This is not a congressional committee.
It's not. It is a congressionally appointed committee, and the White House is considering it a legislative body and says traditionally White House staff members don't testify before legislative bodies, and therefore Condi Rice should testify in private, as in fact she has done.
Mary Louise, thanks very much. The hearing will continue this afternoon with the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and former Secretary of Defense, William Cohen. The hearing will reconvene at 1:30. I'm Linda Wertheimer, NPR News.
And this is AM 580 WILL Urbana. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sports shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world. Currently, World Harvest is featuring foods from India, including Indian sweets, snacks, paratha, and curries, with taste samplings available. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Well, good morning to you. My name is David Inge. At this point, we will resume something of our normal programming schedule, and then at 12:30, we will rejoin National Public Radio for this afternoon's hearings for the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States. That's the formal name of the commission. Informally, it is known as the 9/11 Commission. The chairman, Mr. Kane, the former Republican governor of New Jersey, said that this, talking about the hearings that they're having today and tomorrow, saying that clearly it's one of the most important hearings the commission will hold. It is the eighth public hearing that they have held, and we will have that coverage today and tomorrow. As just mentioned, at the conclusion of the NPR coverage this afternoon, the scheduled guests are William Cohen, who was Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration, and the current Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. We will, at about 10 or 11:59, get back to something of our usual schedule. We'll have a market update for you. Celeste Quinn will be in. We'll have news from National Public Radio and our AM 580 News staff. There'll be sports and weather, the Writer's Almanac. We'll have another market update at 12:25, and then we'll be getting back to the hearings at 12:30. In the meantime, we thought we could, in about the next 10 or 12 minutes, open up the telephone lines, as we often do when we have these hearings and we have little bits of time to fill, suggesting to people that we'd be interested in your comments on what you have heard so far and on the general issues that have been raised. As always, the number's 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And also, we do have that toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Probably the most interesting guest that will be speaking, perhaps I shouldn't say guest, who will be giving testimony to the commission is going to be happening tomorrow afternoon. And this is Richard Clark, who was the former National Coordinator for Counterterrorism in the National Security Council. This held over from the Clinton administration and into the Bush administration. This is the man now has gotten so much attention for a book that he's written in which he makes the charges that the Bush administration, even though they knew that al-Qaeda was a threat, didn't give it serious attention enough. And as soon as the 9/11 attacks happened, were looking for a way to tie Saddam Hussein to those attacks. He was interviewed the other night on 60 Minutes, and his book is getting a great deal of attention. He is scheduled to testify tomorrow afternoon at beginning at 1 o'clock our time. And we will, of course, have that coverage. If you're interested in finding out more information about the 9/11 Commission, by the way, and you have access to the internet, they have a website, and the site is easy to find. It's www.911commission.gov, and there is a hyphen in the 9/11. It has information about past hearings. I believe that transcripts of all of the past hearings are there if you want to read them. Also, this morning, if you were listening to our coverage, there was a fairly lengthy statement by the staff dealing with issues of diplomacy based on some of the investigation they have done. And there will be other staff statements presented during these hearings. If like you, you were sitting there wishing that you could take notes, it's not necessary. Again, that is if you have internet access, because those staff statements are also there on their website so that you can go back there and read them. So that's www.9-11commission.gov. We have a caller here. We'll get right to someone on a mobile phone on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I just have a comment. As someone who, I didn't vote for Bush last time, but I work with many people who did, and some of the people who voted Republican last time keep telling me is they're finding it really hard to trust this administration anymore. They and I don't understand why they're not wanting to have Ms. Rice or Dr. Rice come in and speak, and why they've thrown up so many roadblocks. If the administration, with the economy and everything going the way it is, with his war on terrorism being his center point of his reelection campaign, it seems to me he might be cutting his own wrists, being so, throwing up so many roadblocks and trying to find out the truth behind what happened.
Yeah, I think it's a point a lot of people make. And in fact, I don't know if you recall back in, I think that it was in the fall of 2002 when the discussion about setting up this commission was first done. The Bush administration didn't even want to have the commission set up in the first place.
Exactly. And then, you know, not wanting them to give them an extended period of time, you know, it's just like, I'm a Democrat. Just like with the election of 2000, it seems like, you know, deadlines are more important than democracy. And it seems like he's wanting a deadline is more important to him than finding out the truth of what happened. Yeah. And So that's just my comment.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate that. Other people who are listening, certainly we welcome your comments. If you want to talk about anything that's been discussed here so far, some of the issues raised by the commission, we do have a little bit of time here. We're interested in what you think. Again, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line, and that means if it was would be a long-distance call for you, we will pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Just also a mention, too, if you're interested in following what will be happening, that tomorrow the guests, I keep continuing to say guests, those people who have been called, I guess it is an invitation to testify before the committee, include George Tenet, who is director of CIA, Sandy Berger, who was the former assistant to the president for national security affairs. This was in the Clinton administration. He was the national security advisor. And also, as I mentioned, Richard Clark, former national coordinator for counterterrorism on the National Security Council. Those are the people who are scheduled to testify tomorrow. And we believe that tomorrow's hearings will get underway a little earlier than today. The last word we have is that we're expecting at 7:30 our time they will begin, and we'll have that live coverage from National Public Radio. Caller next up over in Belgium by Danville. Line 4. Hello.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to point out that every time there's a disagreement with our president, he, with some of the people who have worked for him, he always castigates them. Now, this is like this Mr. Clark, and then there was Mr. O'Neill. It seems like every time somebody says something against him, he makes them look very, very ugly. Same thing goes with Mr. Butler, way back at the beginning of this 9/11 thing. He kept saying, though, there's no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Lo and behold, he was right. But they turned public opinion against him at that time, too. Seems to be an interesting trait this administration has. Hmm.
Well, I guess we'll have to see how people feel about this as time goes along. If it seems that more and more former members of the administration come forward and are critical, I guess we'd have to see if that causes more people to question the administration and its policy.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Let's go to, we have somebody again here on a mobile phone. This line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I am a college professor, actually, from Kent State University, traveling west. I just noticed, listening to the hearing on your station,
uh-huh,
in range, was the mention of the administration in total silence during the destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhas in April and May of 2001. It seems to me that that was clearly a sign that they were dealing with a regime which was capable of destructively irrational things, and that was a sign to me that they should have been paying much closer attention. But, you know, I don't even recall one mention from anybody in the administration about that. Anyway, I just wondered if anybody else had any comments.
Yeah, I guess I don't remember the administration saying anything about that. It was something that got a lot of attention in media, and particularly from people who had some, because of their academic disciplines, had some connection to that and said, this is a tragic loss. I'm not exactly sure what the United States government could have done about it. I don't know. Do you think that we would have been in any position to have prevented it?
Well, I'm not sure that it could have been prevented. I just think that the silence of the administration was indicative. Also, if anybody has read any of the two books, or the two main books by Ahmed Rashid, Taliban and Jihad, mm-hmm, he will see a further discussion of something that Madeleine Albright mentioned just in passing this morning. Maybe it was not Madeleine Albright. Maybe it was the first summary of the commission's findings, and that was that the ideas that some people in the Clinton administration floated of a pipeline through Afghanistan, those ideas continued throughout the early months of the Bush administration. He notes that those discussions were still going on at the same time, essentially, as the Bamiyan Buddhas were being destroyed. Anyway, I don't know, for what it's worth, whether that is indicative of anything or not. But thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We'll try and get one more caller here in West Champaign on line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while since I've taken high school civics, but the argument the administration is putting forth against Dr. Rice testifying being a problem with separation of powers, I believe I learned in high school civics that separation of powers, the declaration of war was a power reserved to Congress, and yet our president took this unto himself as a gift from Congress. And now he's citing separation of powers against Dr. Rice, and I'm not quite sure I understand the separation of powers as it's being handled by this administration.
Well, I think that at the least some of the members of this commission would agree with you. They don't quite understand why it is they're making this argument either. The other point you raise, I think, is a very interesting one, and that is the power to declare war. And I guess to the best of my recollection, the last time the United States actually declared war was, I think that it was World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we've been involved in a number of wars since. That's one of those things that now and again I thought it would be worth having some discussion here on the program, actually. What exactly it means when we say the Congress has the power to declare war, and yet obviously we've fought quite a few that were not declared.
I believe Korea was always a police action.
Yes.
I think
that that's correct. I think you raise an excellent question, but again, particularly the one about what the justification of the White House for Condoleezza Rice is.
It doesn't fly.
Declining to appear. No, it really doesn't. Well, I thank you.
Thank you.
I thank you very much. I think we're getting very close to the point here that we're going to have to conclude this little impromptu open line. I'm sure that we'll have some other opportunities, and then perhaps on some of our talk programming, we'll also see if we can get to some of these issues. And, of course, suggestions for topics and guests, we'd be very happy to have them, and we'll do our best to see what we can do. Again, a reminder that coming up at 12:30 our time, we expect to rejoin National Public Radio for coverage of this afternoon's session of the 9/11 Commission. And those people who are scheduled to be testifying include William Cohen, who was Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration, and then the current Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld. Right now, I think we'll turn things over to Celeste Quinn, the host of the Afternoon Magazine, who will take us through the next half an hour before we get back to National Public Radio.
Thank you very much, David. Good morning, everyone. Here's what's coming up in the noon hour this afternoon. We'll have a market update here first. We'll have news from National Public Radio at 12:06. Tom Rogers will be in with AM 580 News. We'll have a short sportscast following that. That will be followed by weather, the Writer's Almanac, and another market update at the bottom of the half hour here. And then at 12:30, as David mentioned, we anticipate we will be returning to National Public Radio for further live coverage of the 9/11 Commission hearings. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. May wheat, 416.5, down 6.25. July wheat, 420, down 6.75.